The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Another gorgeous day at Edstone. Gorgeous with a capital G. Just nice and sunny outside, mid-70s. We'll have to get outside a little bit this afternoon to enjoy that. We're at the point in the year where the days are quite a lot longer as well. So lots of sunlight at the end of the day, even after the workday, on into 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So beautiful day. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up in the second segment, I probably will get into a little more on the subject of service, which I ended yesterday's show with. I know I also mentioned that I'd like to talk about what the Bible says regarding the royal wedding, the marriage between Jesus Christ and the church. And I might have to hold off on that until tomorrow, because I do have a fair bit packed into this first segment. But hopefully the second segment, we can have a short study. And then if we have time, we're going to try to squeeze in an even shorter third segment and draw attention to one of our locals here, one of our church members who made the front page of one of the local papers in Stratford-upon-Avon. He was in a contest recently. And, well, I don't want to give it all away. I'll just make you anticipate the very tail end of today's show, where hopefully we can play a fun clip for you and draw attention to our new local celebrity. So yesterday, President Trump met with the Deputy Attorney General, the FBI Director, and the Director of National Intelligence following his demand on Sunday that the DOJ investigate these many reports, these nonstop reports of the Obama team spying on the Trump campaign in 2016. The White House Press Secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she said that in this meeting it was agreed that the White House Chief of Staff would immediately set up another meeting with the FBI, DOJ, and DNI, and that they together with congressional leaders, you know, there's lots of congressional leaders like Devin Nunes, as I quoted from yesterday, that are trying to get to the bottom of how the investigation started in the first place. And so it's unclear at this point if these additional meetings will reveal more documents. But as you heard on yesterday's show, we covered it, the news that unfolded through the weekend, President Trump's reaction to all of the leaks last week, revealing that the FBI had an informant in the Trump campaign. The New York Post, by the way, over the weekend, it talks some about this Cambridge professor. He's a 73-year-old academic, Stephen Halper. He teaches down at Cambridge here in the UK. And he's the one that arranged to meet with all of these Trump campaign advisors, Carter Page, George Papadopoulos. There was a third individual. I forget his name offhand. But this article talks about how that these latest revelations have just given more ammunition to the Obama critics, who are saying that, well, look, you don't even have any evidence as to how this got started, this investigation. And if anything, Stephen Halper and some of these other most recent revelations indicate that there's some kind of entrapment here. That Papadopoulos and Carter Page and some others were set up. The New York Post says that Halper's sit-downs with Page reportedly started in early July 2016, undermining James Comey's previous claim that the Bureau's investigation into the Trump campaign began at the end of that month. So I think the official date is July 31st, 2016. Well, the meetings between Halper and Papadopoulos, or Page at least, they happened in early July. So it's calling into question the timeline that's been established by all of these former Obama officials, whether it's Comey or Clapper or Brennan. And those on the House Intel Committee, they're wondering if it started even way back before the early part of July, as early as March 21st, 2016. If you remember, probably most of you don't, but Trump was becoming the front runner. And many in the media were criticizing him because, well, he doesn't, you know, he's kind of an outsider. He doesn't really have any foreign policy advisors. So he has this this interview with the Washington Post on March 21st, 2016. And the reason that interview or that particular exchange is important is because President Trump revealed that he had Carter Page and George Papadopoulos and some others that were forming his the early foreign policy advisors. This is from the New York Post. It says Halper contacted Papadopoulos by email. The professor offered the young inexperienced campaign. Well, I went through some of these details yesterday. The $3,000 that he offered for the paper, and then the all expenses paid the paid trip to London to talk about this paper. And through it all, of course, this informant or this spy was trying to feed him with information and also get information from him. And the reason this is all important is because it was Papadopoulos, as you might remember, who apparently said to that Australian diplomat, Alexander Downer, that the Russians had all of these emails, all of these Hillary Clinton emails. Downer then reported the conversation to U.S. authorities sometime in July 2016. And that, according to Comey and some others now, because the dossier has been proven to be a giant fraud, That's the trigger. That's what started the investigation. Downer reported this to U.S. authorities. And this Alexander Downer, as I mentioned yesterday, it just so happens that he signed off on Australian taxpayers giving the Clinton Foundation $25 million back in 2006. The Spectator had a piece today about that shady transaction. Again, and the Australian taxpayers are on the hook for this, or at least they were. Spectator says, yet another taxpayer-funded Clinton Foundation boondoggle where nobody knows how the money was spent. This one was served up to the Australian taxpayers by none other than the same Alexander Downer, who 10 years later would just happen to cross paths with George Papadopoulos while Bill Clinton's wife was running for president. And also by happy chance, Downer was able to help the Clintons by getting a drunken Papadopoulos to talk about the Russians having dirt on Mrs. Clinton. What a remarkable string of coincidences. I mean, this is just incredible. The New York Post, regarding this informant, it says that he was paid $282,000 in 2016, paid by the Department of Defense's Office of Net Assessment, this Halper fellow that works at Cambridge. He was paid $282,000 in 2016 and then $129,000 last year. It's a pretty good paycheck for being a spy. And he's been, as was covered in those leaks on Friday night, he's been working for U.S. intelligence agencies for decades. I played those clips for you yesterday from Devin Nunez, the interview that he had on Sunday. And let me just repeat a short snippet from what he said on Fox News Sunday, clip one.
And we don't know if there's one informant or more informants because there's so much out there now. It's really getting tough to follow. And all we're asking for is give us the documentation that you used to start this investigation.
So we played that yesterday, but I just wanted to key in on the fact that he said there, we don't know if there's one informant or if there's more informants, because there's just so much out there. There's so much being leaked. And what we're asking for is information on these informants or this informant, and also on how the investigation got started in the first place. This is Devin Nunez really circling the target, as one conservative blog pointed out. I mean, this representative deserves some kind of award for his political courage. He is trying to get to the bottom of this. And this may just be the beginning. This Stephen Halper. There may be more to come. If you listen to Michael Caputo from a Fox News interview last night, if you didn't hear my program from a couple of weeks ago, this is the Michael Caputo that he had to give a testimony either before the Senate or the House, and then he was later grilled by Robert Mueller's team of investigators, prosecutors, those left-wing prosecutors, and he was subjected to questions from them for about 3 hours. This is the Michael Caputo here again. He was a low-level campaign supporter for the Trump campaign, and then now he's being grilled, and he's not even a target, but he talked about just how costly this is. I mean, Mueller, on the one hand, has an unlimited budget, but just a regular old American citizen like Michael Caputo, he's got to hire a team of lawyers and defend himself. This is what he said on Fox News last night, clip two.
Let me tell you something that I know for a fact. This informant, this person that they tried to plant into the campaign and even into the administration, if you believe Axios, he's not the only person that came at the campaign. And the FBI is not the only Obama agency that came at the campaign. I know because they came at me. And I'm looking for clearance from my attorney to reveal this to the public. This is just the beginning. And I'll tell you, when we finally find out the truth about this, Director Clapper and the rest of them are going to be wearing some orange suits.
Some strong words there coming from Michael Caputo, who used to be a low-level supporter of the Trump campaign in New York State. This is only the beginning. And he indicates there that he's just waiting for his lawyers to give him clearance, so that he can talk about another informant. The deep state is in deep trouble. Mueller's investigation appears to be unraveling. Yesterday, there were more emails revealed. The back and forth between the FBI and the DOJ in those crucial days in early January 2017, this time when President Trump was briefed on some of the salacious details in the dossier. You'll remember that, January 6th, 2017, and then the inauguration was 2 weeks later. Cheryl Atkinson, she had a blog post talking about these email exchanges, and this so-called sensitive matter team. That's the phrase that appears in some of these exchanges, that they had this sensitive matter, and there were a few in on this team. And of course, the sensitive matter, it revolved around the dossier and the Trump-Russia collusion story. And she explains in her blog posting that these emails were obtained by the Inspector General. Remember, I said on yesterday's show that all of these leaks that happened last week, they're happening just days ahead of the Inspector General's report. And the deep state knows it's not going to look good. It's not going to make them look very good at all. So these are emails that the Inspector General came across, and then he turned them over to the Senate Homeland Security Committee. This is headed up by Chairman Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. And he then wrote a letter to the FBI Director, Christopher Wray, on Monday, just yesterday, asking for the identity of all these members on this team, this sensitive matter team. This is from Cheryl Atkinson's piece. She says, according to Senator Johnson's letter, that would be from Monday, yesterday, Comey Chief of Staff, Rybicki, emailed unidentified recipients on the morning of January 6th, 2017. And then it quotes from his email, Director Comey is coming to headquarters briefly now for an update on the sensitive matter team. It says, later in the day, Comey briefed President-elect Trump on a few of the salacious unverified allegations in the Steele dossier. The next day, this is Cheryl Atkinson writing, Comey reported on his briefing in an email to FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. All of these individuals have either resigned or been fired. These holdovers from Obama, they were there, though, during the transition. It says he sent the email, Comey did, to Andy McCabe, FBI General Counsel James Baker, and Chief of Staff Rybicki. It says later, I said there was something Director Clapper wanted me to speak to President Trump, President-elect Trump about, alone or in a very small group. That's quoting from Comey's email to this sensitive matter team. And then it says here, I then executed, this is quoting Comey, I executed the session exactly as I had planned. I said media like CNN had them and were looking for a news hook. So he told, and some of this we went through a week or two ago, but he told President-elect Trump that, look, these news agencies, they have this salacious dossier, okay, and they're looking for a news hook to report on it. This is what Comey said to the president, the president-elect. Now, Atkinson says in her piece here, a day later, January 8th, FBI Deputy Director McCabe emailed Comey and Rybicki with the subject title, Flood is Coming. So they briefed the president on January 6th, and then immediately the emails go back and forth. You've got Director Comey, you've got James Baker, you've got the Chief of Staff Rybicki, you've got Andrew McCabe. And then McCabe emails everyone back on the 8th saying, the flood is coming. What does he mean by that? Cheryl Atkinson says, this is quoting McCabe, CNN is close to going forward with the sensitive story. So McCabe knew on January the 8th, the story came out on the 10th. They knew right after that meeting with President Trump that the flood was coming. The media flood. The coverage of the dossier. Quoting McCabe, it says, the trigger, that would be the hook, that Comey speaks of, the trigger for them is they know the material was discussed in the presidential brief and presented in an attachment. There was evidently a two-page summary that I think CNN said Comey gave to the president. Comey denied that, but he got a summary, some kind of a summary, and he certainly got the briefing from Comey himself. And of course, as I covered with you last week or the week before, Comey was very selective about what he told the president. Just basically some of the salacious gossip. He didn't tell him about the background of Steele, the fact that he was a liar, the fact that he had been fired. He didn't tell them that the dossier was funded by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. None of that. It never came up, as he said, I think, to Brett Baer. But coming back to this email exchange, it says in Cheryl Atkinson's report, within an hour of the flood is coming email, McCabe emailed then deputy director, or rather then deputy general, Sally Yates, and her top aide, Principal Deputy Attorney General Matthew Axelrod, with the subject title, News. Just as an FYI, and as expected, it seems CNN is close to running a story about the sensitive reporting. That's another email that McCabe sent to Sally Yates and others. They all knew that CNN was about to run with the story, and they were all leaking, and Clapper was leading the way. I mean, and judging by these email exchanges, it seems like Andy McCabe might have been involved in a lot of the leaking as well. But anyway, all of this led up to this the great CNN revelation from January the 10th. Their article, which was headlined, Intel Chiefs Presented Trump with Claims of Russian Efforts to Compromise Him. So they had to get the hook. They knew the dossier was unverified. They knew they couldn't run with the dossier just by itself. And so the story on January 10th last year was that Intel chiefs presented Trump with these claims that there were Russian efforts to compromise him. They had the hook now, so they could run with the story. And then BuzzFeed followed by printing the entirety of the dossier. Now, Clapper, as you might remember, told Congress that he never ever discussed the Steele dossier or any other intelligence related to Russia election interference with journalists. And then he came back later and said, well, actually, I did talk about it with Jake Tapper. And maybe I talked about it with some other journalists, too. But let me take you back to what Jim Comey had to say regarding where these leaks came from. Brett Baer of Fox News, this was from April 26th. Just a few weeks ago. This is Brett Baer pressing Comey on where the leaks came from. Clip 3.
Speaking of CNN, you write in the memos of that meeting, you write, I said to President-elect Trump, media like CNN had the dossier and were looking for a news hook. I said it was inflammatory stuff. So the story of that briefing leaks out almost immediately after you do it. CNN and others run the story of this unverified dossier. Did you or your subordinates leak that?
No.
Did James Clapper?
No, not to my knowledge. No.
John Brennan?
I don't know who leaked it. I had no part in any leaking of it. It was about 4 or 5 days later that it leaked, but I remember because President-elect called me about it.
Did you ever try to find out?
Who leaked an unclassified public document? No.
If you notice the way that he answered that question at the end, who leaked an unclassified public document? That's speaking of the dossier. But Brett Baer originally was asking about who leaked the details of the briefing. The briefing that they had with the incoming president. And then Comey gets a little shifty in his answers. Says, not to my knowledge, when it comes to James Clapper or John Brennan. And then, did you ever find out? I mean, did you want to find out who leaked it? I mean, these are felonious actions. Did you were the FBI director. Did you investigate this? Did you try to clamp down on leaks? He shifts the subject matter, saying that who leaked an unclassified public document? In other words, it's no big deal to leak something like that. Everybody knew about it. The media had copies of the dossier. And so then he concludes by saying, "No, I didn't have anything to do with it." Just carefully worded answers, because they were all leaking. They were in collusion with the left wing media, the deep state, Obama's deep state. In collusion with the left-wing media. And if you notice, and this has been true all the way up through to last week, all of these leaks coming from the FBI, coming from the DOJ, they always make their way over to CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post. How come you never read about leaks reaching the Spectator or National Review or the Daily Caller or Fox News? It's always CNN. It's always the New York Times. It's always the Washington Post. And that's because the leakers know that they're going to get the very best angle coming from their allies in the left-wing media. They're going to get the left-wing narrative. In collusion, Democrats and the media, none of them are horrified by the politically motivated spying that went on in the last years of the Obama presidency. You listen to them today, and they're all aggressively defending Obama's spying. And then President Trump finally comes out on Sunday and says, hey, I demand that we have an investigation into all of this spying that went on. And Obama's defenders, what do? Oh, they denounce President Trump. He's politicizing the DOJ, if you can believe it. They have the audacity to say that President Trump is politicizing the DOJ and the FBI. They're defending all of the illegal spying on American citizens. The New York Times, I mentioned this yesterday, after they revealed all of the details last week, together with the Washington Post, then they come out with their headline, FBI used informant to investigate Russia ties, not to spy, as Trump claims. We're not spying. We're investigating. Stephen Halper, he's investigating. Well, they can call it what they want, but in the real world, secretively gathering information about someone else and getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for it, that's called spying. But all of the Obama defenders, it's so predictable. You have the conservative wing, the much smaller wing in conservative media and talk radio, and then you have the mainstream. And so many of these top officials during Obama's administration, like Sally Yates, she was the one that Donald Trump fired early on into his presidency because she defied his travel ban. She just basically sent out a a letter instructing officials not to enforce what President Trump said to enforce. Here she is, yesterday, talking about President Trump and his decision to investigate all of this spying that went on in the DOJ and at the FBI. Here's clip four.
I think what we're seeing here is the president has just taken his all-out assault on the rule of law to a new level. Mm-hmm. And this time, he is ordering up an investigation of the investigators who are examining his own campaign. You know, that's really shocking.
These are the former leaders of those intel agencies. She's appalled that you would ever investigate the investigators, because in her mind, that was the thinking in Obama's deep state. The investigators are above reproach. And if they lie, or if they leak, or if they cheat, that's fine. The ends justify the means. If they commit felonies, if they obstruct justice, if they scrub servers, if they destroy emails, if they lie under oath, that's just par for the course. President Trump comes along, his administration, after all these reports leaked through the liberal media. He says, we've got to look into this. We've got to investigate this. And all of a sudden, he's assaulting the rule of law after what we've seen for the past 8 years. Here's the former director of national intelligence. This is James Clapper. Assault. That's the word that they're throwing out there. Clip five.
I think that's actually a very disturbing assault on the independence of the Department of Justice. And I think when the president, this president or any president, tries to use the Department of Justice as kind of a private investigatory body, that's not good for the country.
If any president uses the DOJ as a private investigatory body, that's not good. See, he cannot imagine a world where President Obama would have done anything like that. Obama used the CIA to spy on the legislative branch. And then his CIA chief, John Brennan, went out there and lied to the American people. We didn't do that. Clapper, you know about his lies. He spied on the American people with domestic surveillance, the domestic surveillance program. And then he lied about it under oath to Congress. Obama's DOJ spied on and even prosecuted journalists. They would not tolerate leaks during the Obama years. Now, of course, those intel agencies are leaking like sieves. Here's Clapper again, saying that this was last week, actually. It got quite a lot of attention in the conservative media. Clapper basically saying that, well, it's a good thing that the Trump administration was spied on. Here's clip six.
The focus here, and as it was with the intelligence community, is not on the campaign per se, but what the Russians were doing to try to instantiate themselves in the campaign or to influence or leverage it. So if there was someone that was observing that sort of thing, well, that's a good thing.
That's a good thing that we were observing this, because, look, after all, we don't care about Donald Trump and his administration. We could have been a lot harder on him. But we've got to be concerned about the Russians, what the Russians are doing. So they did all this spying on the Trump administration, not the Hillary administration or campaign, but the Trump administration and campaign, supposedly to find out about the Russians. This was Clapper yesterday morning in another interview, clip seven.
The important thing here is a foreign nation, particularly an adversary, trying to influence a political campaign. And that's not good for the country. In fact, we ought to think about it as part of the effort of the FBI to keep the nation safe and secure and protect our voting process.
We're just trying to protect the voting process and keep our nation secure. This is how they justify spying on U.S. citizens. We have to make sure that we uphold the integrity of our election process. We don't want the Russians meddling. We don't want the Russians tampering in our election process. But the thing of it is, when Obama was presiding over those departments and knew about the Russian meddling, He did nothing. And this has been widely reported. It's not gotten near enough attention. We played it for you on this program a few weeks back. This was from a CNN report on March 27th. Here's CNN inadvertently revealing some details that certainly don't make the Obama administration look good. Here's clip 8.
Russia still denies it, but the Twitter war, the fake news, the social media attacks, Putin's new weapon of war, as some call it, was launched against Ukraine in 2014 during its election. And just like a Cold War battle, a counteroffensive set up by the U.S. State Department pushed back. The Russians backed off, but they didn't go away. They just got better. And one former U.S. official said he tried to sound the alarm that the Russians would try the same tactics in the U.S.
During the 2016 elections, they came at us with exactly the same kinds of techniques that they were using back in Ukraine.
According to Brett Bruen, then director of global engagement on the U.S. National Security Council, it was a sign of what was to come, the Russians' new weapon of war. And he says in 2014, 2 years before the U.S. election, he urged the State Department to keep the task force up and running and build on it.
And I was sitting at the White House telling the State Department, for the love of God, keep this up. We have a threat, a new threat, that we have recognized, that we have been successful in many respects in pushing back against. This is not the moment for us to stand down.
Bruen pitched a command center that would track and counter Russian misinformation. But he says the State Department dismissed the idea. Precisely why isn't clear.
Well, they didn't think Donald Trump would win. That's why. They thought Hillary would win. And they thought, you know, the Russian meddling for whatever it accomplished, it's not going to influence the election one way or the other. Which was probably true, but the point I want to make is that if they're so serious about maintaining the integrity of the election process, what were they doing in March and July and August and October of 2016? Or what were they doing in 2014 when Brett Bruen was at the White House, as he said there in that report, telling them, don't stand down. We've got to counter this. Here's another snippet from that same report, clip 9.
Whatever the reason, the warning of the looming Russian threat was not shared across the Obama administration.
They didn't act. They didn't do anything. There's that story from March 9th again. We've referred to this on the program as well, about Susan Rice. They wanted in the White House cybersecurity, the cybersecurity team in the White House, they wanted to counter what the Russians were doing. And Susan Rice comes along in August of 2016 and says, no, stop. Stand down. Don't get ahead of Barack Obama on this. That article from March 9th, it talks about the new book, the Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. And the book goes through and shows how Obama made a decision not to actively resist or aggressively resist those Russian attempts. The article, this is Kyle Becker's piece at BizPak, it says, at one pivotal point during the presidential campaign, Susan Rice directly told the White House Director of Cybersecurity, Michael Daniel, to cease and desist from developing further technological options to thwart apparent Russian attempts to create havoc in the digital elections infrastructure. And it goes on to quote and paraphrase from this new book, saying that it was in late August when Susan Rice confronted Michael Daniel and made this demand, cease and desist, stop what you're doing, don't get ahead of President Obama. That was in late August 2016. And then here's Barack Obama, President Obama himself, 6 weeks later. This is just what you hear in the next clip. Is what President Obama said just 3.5 weeks before the election in early November 2016. Here's President Obama.
But the larger point that I want to emphasize here is that there is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that You could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized and the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that there are instances in which that will happen this time. And so I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes. And if he got the most votes, then it would be my expectation of Hillary Clinton to offer a gracious concession speech and pledge to work with him in order to make sure that the American people benefit from an effective government.
And I don't think the Democrats have followed through on that pledge to support Donald Trump. It's amazing, isn't it, how different the deep state operated when Obama was calling the shots, as opposed to the way it functions now under the Trump administration. All of these vicious, outrageous acts, assaults. Who's being assaulted? That should be clear. My father, as I've said so many times in recent weeks, that article in the May edition of The Trumpet where he talks about the hoax, this investigation into Donald Trump, of all things. And it's becoming more and more clear that this Mueller investigation was meant from the beginning. Comey set it up. He admitted he set it up. He wrote the memos. He released them to his friend who released them to the media in the hope that it would trigger a Mueller investigation or a special counsel. And that's what happened. And it's been going on now more than a year. And really the whole focus and intent of that investigation, it certainly hasn't turned up any Russian collusion evidence. It's there more to conceal what was happening in the last year of President Obama's administration. All the spying, the dossier, the FISA applications, the wiretaps. My father said in that piece that it's revealing the law breaking there in the radical left. He said the previous president filled America's law enforcement agencies with treasonous agents. And you see it with this latest revelation, all these emails from January 6th to January 10, 2017. You see all of these treasonous motivations to bring down an incoming president. There's an article coming out in the next Trumpet. The U.S. government at war with itself. That should be out here. It'll probably be posted sooner, actually, at thetrumpet.com. But there's a war going on between the deep state and the Trump administration. And really, this assault, and it's coming from the radical left primarily. There's a little bit of pushback coming from the Trump administration, but the assault's coming from the radical left. And behind that, of course, is the spirit and power of the devil, the god of this world. And like we bring out in that forthcoming article, I mean, this is an attack. This is an assault that we've seen before. It's happened in a church. It's happened in God's church in this end time. Following the death of Herbert Armstrong in 1986, Satan attacked the church from the top. He came in there with a new ideology, with a hatred for the past, with a hatred for the Constitution, so to speak. And he used powerful leaders at the top to confuse and deceive the people. And it operated slowly and subtly at the start. But by the end, I mean, here were the leaders of a church. After saying they were loyal to the principles of the past, they just came forward and said, nope, everything about our foundation, everything about our history, it's all wrong, and we're going in a new direction. It's the same strategy at play this time around. Again, if you haven't read my father's books, America Under Attack and Great Again, now is the time to do it. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
So yesterday on the program, I quoted from the new booklet, the Ruth booklet, my father talking about the annual festival of Pentecost. And he said that that festival, that holy day, is about giving yourself, giving to the world, even dying for the world if you have to, giving everything that you have to God to get this work done. He goes on and says, that's what we're going to be doing for all eternity as the bride of Christ. How important is that? Is that role of supporting God's work, whether as a member or a co-worker or a donor? In Matthew 10, verse 5, it says, these 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the ways of the Gentiles or the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter you not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So these were the disciples who later became apostles, who after Acts 15, I mean, they disappeared from the story there in the New Testament because they went to the northwestern reaches of Europe to preach to the Israelites, the lost sheep of Israel, of the house of Israel, it says there. But just to focus on the instructions that God gave to his disciples, verse 7, it says, and as you go, preach, saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand, heal the sick and cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, it says, cast out demons, freely you have received, freely give. Here was Christ commanding his disciples to deliver this truth, this warning message to the people of Israel primarily, and to make it available to them freely. And so this is why Herbert Armstrong went to this verse often, or at least he referred to it, when he talked about distributing all of that material, the books and the booklets, the magazines, distributing it freely. This is why we don't charge for those many publications that we send out all over the world. But now, obviously, I mean, those publications, those magazines, the TV time that we purchase, it all costs a lot of money. So how does this work get done? Well, God places the financial responsibility of furthering this warning work. He places that responsibility upon those he calls out of the world and into the church. On those minds, he opens to the truth. And then they come along into the church or support the work as co-workers with their tithes and offerings, and the work gets done. Verse 9 says, provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves, for the workman is worthy of his meat. So you just walk by faith. Just put your heart in the work. My father wrote in a letter back in 1999, this went out to our coworkers. He said, Christ sent these men out armed only with faith. And that's what we need to get this work done, the faith to give all the support we can to God's work. He said we must get our minds off ourselves and onto why we're in God's church today. God will provide all of our needs if our heart is in the work. And he went on to paraphrase Mr. Armstrong, who said that if your heart's in the work, you're going to be growing spiritually. God's work. The growth of God's work, it's because of those members, those co-workers and donors who put their hearts into the work of God. I mean, that's why God brings us into his church in the first place. We're being trained and taught to teach the world. We're being prepared and made ready to marry Jesus Christ. But the primary reason that we've been called out of this world and into the church in these last days is because of the support that we need to provide for God's church, for God's work. Sunday, that would have been May 20th. That's when we, 5 years ago, that's when we paid off the construction loan for God's house. I forget how many years we had that loan. I guess the house, we broke ground on that. What was it, in 2008, I believe? I know the grand opening was in 2010. I mean, here's this breathtaking edifice on our headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. Something like $25 million. And I mean, ours is a church that just has 5,000-6,000 people scattered over the world. And we've got all of this TV time that we're purchasing. We've got all of this literature that we send out. And then at that time, I mean, from 2008 to 2010... we're constructing this $25 million house for God. And May 20th, 2013, that was the day we paid off the loan. I mean, completely paid for. And now here we are hard at work paying off the G450. That purchase, I forget the exact cost of that, but we received delivery on that just a little over a year ago. And already it's been all over the world, that plane, that aircraft, that tool, that instrument. And God's people, God's co-workers and donors, those who have their hearts in the work, they're the ones supporting this effort, this end of the end time effort. How important is your role, your individual role? I touched on this a week or two ago. I mean, here we're on a planet with 7.4 billion people. And even if you bump it up to 10,000 saints, like it says there in the book of Deuteronomy, that only amounts to one for every 750,000 people. That means we have an important role to play. And when we come in and put our hearts into the work, that makes what we're doing just crucially important. But we're here, as my father said in that 1999 article, we're here to serve. Whether it's with tithes and donations or the way that you pray to God in support of the work or in the way that we let our light shine. Serving God, not like they serve in leadership positions of the world. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, as Jesus said in Luke 22. But it's different in God's church. Let me read through a few verses in Matthew 20. This is where Jesus explains what it means here to lead. He explains this to his disciples. Let's talk about leadership. Matthew 20 and verse 25 says, but Jesus called them unto him and said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion or lordship over them, and they are and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. That's the key. Servant leadership. Be a minister to others. Be a servant. That's what the Greek word for minister means. Service. He carries on further in verse 27 and says, whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Here it's a different Greek word. It means slave. If you really want to be a leader for God, if you really want to take on greater responsibility, then be a slave. Be a slave to God. We're bought with a price, after all. That word for servant there, it means slave, therefore, in a qualified sense of subjection or subserviency. That's the key to greatness, taking on that slave-like mentality, really being service-oriented in all that we do and say. It says in verse 28, I mean, Jesus, of course, is the perfect example when it comes to this service-oriented attitude. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus Christ, of course, was the greatest servant of all time. He came to serve mankind. He came to teach us how to be servant leaders. He taught that service and sacrifice is the highest possible calling that we can attain. And really, if you look at the authority that backed Jesus Christ, I mean, if ever there was a man who could have reasoned that, well, I need to be ministered unto, it was Jesus Christ. And yet look at his ministry. He was a powerful and persuasive leader. There's no doubt about that. But he was a servant. It was servant leadership. He washed his disciples' feet. And then he said to his disciples, now you follow my example. You serve without giving any thought to what you might get in return. God reserves the greatest honor in his family, in his kingdom, the highest positions to those who are the most ambitious servants. That's the direction our ambition needs to be aimed in. Just seek to serve God. We're here. We're here, after all, to serve the entire world. That Ruth booklet that I quoted from at the start of the segment, my father includes 7 points there on how to become the bride of Christ. And the seventh and final point that you can study in that booklet is that we're here to serve the world. When we come back, we'll talk briefly about our newest local celebrity from Stratford-upon-Avon. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
So when I walked into my office this morning, I saw the front page of what's called the Midweek Herald. This is put out in Stratford-upon-Avon, and there featured above the fold on the front page, it says, car crooner Albert is top of the motoring festival pops. That's referring to our very own Albert Clark. He's a 4-year graduate of Armstrong College. He was off in Edmond, Oklahoma for 4 years, and then he returned back, I guess, a year ago. And I had forgotten that he did some voice training while he was there. But they had this contest, I think it was 2 weeks ago, May 6th and 7th. And it was at this festival, and it was called Car Aoki, not karaoke, car, because they had to sit inside of a car and turn on the music and then basically sing like a 50s-style song before judges. And of all the contestants, I don't know how many there were, but Albert comes out on top, and there's this brilliant photo of him kneeling down like a youngish Oh, Dean Martin, or who's the guy that sang New York, New York? That guy. He's in front of this sports car looking as handsome as ever and singing a song. Here's Albert. I think he tweeted this out the other day. Here's a little sampling of Albert singing during that competition. Clip 11.
But you know you're not dreaming, Signore. Excuse me, but you see back in old Napoli, that's amore. When North does hit your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you.
So there you go, Albert. We got to get him on one of our recitals. Didn't realize, again, he got into singing in front of people so much. Why weren't you there, Jonathan? You've done some of our recitals. He didn't have time, Jonathan says. Too busy. Too busy to compete in this festival. I'm just reading the front page story while you were listening to the clip there. It says more than 45,000 people attended the Stratford BID organized event, with many taking time out from looking around the 300 plus cars on show to take part in Stratford's own version of the popular TV show Carpool Karaoke. So congratulations to our very own Albert Clark for winning the competition. And he's automatically signed up for our next AC recital in the fall. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.